Friends, there is an old saying about human nature that still waters run deep. And it is common experience that time is required in order to understand and appreciate the deeper and finer qualities of one's fellow men. Yet these qualities are present all the time. When we first meet people, we don't see the deeper sides to their characters, but nevertheless, the whole of the person is there all the time. Everyone has characteristics, then, which only long association with them enables one to discover. We might very well ask, then, in what way do these qualities of human nature exist? Do we all carry our characters about with us? And if so, where are they, and in what form? Also, are there any means by which our capacities, our habits and tendencies, and our outlook on life in general can be quickly perceived? Well, that is part of my theme in this address. World religions and world philosophies, ancient and modern, do give us answers to these problems. They teach that the visible universe, which we see about us all the time, the visible universe is the outer physical manifestation of an inner hidden life. This inner aspect, it is taught, is the reality, and the outer temporal world is only its reflection or shadow. A great deal of information is in fact available concerning what we might call the invisible universe. For instance, it is said to occupy the same space as the material planets do, and to interpenetrate and vitalize them. Also, this inner universe, if I may use the term, is said to extend far beyond the physical planets, the sun, and the edge, so to say, of the solar system, right out into outer space. The inner world of which the philosophers and seers tell us is said to be one of light. Its very substance is self-radiant, glowing with myriad hues, and also, yes, it is inhabited by its own teeming population, and it has its own scenery and conditions. Now, this world of light and life and innumerable presences is here and now and all about us, but normally it is invisible. And this invisibility is due to the fact that its forces vibrate on higher frequencies than our senses can respond to. At death, it is taught, man transfers and limits his life to this inner world, partakes of its life, and becomes subservient to its laws. Nevertheless, even while in the earth, body, man also has his existence in these superphysical realms. And this is because he possesses and uses vehicles of consciousness, bodies, if you like, made of their subtle substances. Theosophy has a great deal to say, both in general and, fortunately, in considerable detail about this inner world and man's bodies and life within it. Theosophy teaches that man is very much more than this physical body and nature which we see. Maeterlinck put it in rather a different way. He said, every existing body is prolonged in time and space. Its head is bathed in duration, and its feet are rooted in extension. Rather a fine saying of the famous Belgian philosopher. Shall I say it again? Every existing body is prolonged in time and space. Its head is bathed in duration, and its feet are rooted in extension. That's pure theosophy and perfectly true about every human being. Naturally and normally, we don't see the whole man. We only see cross-sections of him. And this is also true of the universe as a whole. We only contact cross-sections of the totality. This becomes very apparent when we first meet other people. Time reveals more of people. We say that, don't we, when we repeat that people grow on us. Nevertheless, all that we later discover about each other was there from the first, but unperceived. The whole man, in fact, is present at every moment of waking life, but fuller comprehension of people's natures and characters dawns slowly upon us. Both the past and the future of every human being also may be said to be present, if only in terms of germinal potentialities and developed powers and faculties. Fully perceived, the complete man would be revealed. Then we'd see a person in his physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual nature, and that would be a wonderful vision, a true vision of the real individuality. Even the humblest man or woman would then be found to possess very great potential qualities and powers. We might even catch glimpses of the inner spirit of man, the dweller in the innermost, as it's called, the shining splendor of the God indwelling in each and every one of us. Indeed, we need a lofty vision to be able to see the whole man. And I sometimes think that perhaps our judgments of each other would be very different, kinder, more understanding, and more tolerant if we could see more of this inner man. In what form do these unseen attributes of human beings exist, and how can they be seen? And if they are seen, what do they look like? Theosophy answers, they exist and may be seen as light. Superphysically, every man is robed in a luminous vesture. This is perhaps referred to in the Bible, where Joseph is said to have been fitted out by his father with a coat of many colors. We are all, as Joseph, you know, having our inner aura full of light and color, our coat of many hues. The human soul, then, is veritably a being of light, and each power and quality shines out in its own hue. Every man, as I've just said, is like Joseph, clothed with a coat of many colours, and each colour represents a power, a quality, a faculty, or a characteristic mode of self-expression. Now, these can be seen and studied by the proper order of vision, a subject into which I haven't really now the time to go very fully. I can, however, bear my own testimony to the existence of this power, and that it does reveal what might be called the colours of the human aura. But of course it is one thing to be able to see them, and there are quite a number of people who do catch glimpses of colour shining about people. It's one thing to see them, and another thing to interpret correctly their real meaning. The interpretation of the colours of the aura in terms of human qualities is in itself a science. All of the superphysical bodies of man are brilliantly coloured, and the significance of each hue varies somewhat according to the vehicle in which it appears, the mental or the emotional body, or some of the higher and more spiritual and immortal bodies of man. Now I'm going to present some of the results of very careful examination by the appropriate order of extended vision of the human aura, but it is so diverse that I'm going to limit myself to the emotional body of man. This is sometimes called the astral body, or even the astral aura. The emotional body of man not only permeates, interpenetrates the physical body, but also surrounds it in every direction, rather like a cloud. That portion which extends beyond the limits of the physical body is usually termed the aura. The aura, then, is ovoid in shape, and, as far as I know, about 3 times the size of the physical body. The central portion of the emotional body takes the exact form of the physical body, and is, in fact, quite clearly distinguishable from the surrounding aura. And therefore it is usually called the astral counterpart. The exact correspondence of the emotional body with the physical is, however, merely a matter of external form, and does not involve any similarity of function in the various organs. Now, what does all this look like, then, to trained clairvoyant sight? Let me suggest some ideas, asking you always to remember that no theosophical teaching is regarded as a dogma, which must be believed. It's true that the information offered has been checked and counter-checked innumerable times, but even so, all of this teaching is offered to us, and I offer it to you, merely as food for thought. Well, to clairvoyant sight, one of the principal features of an emotional body consists of its colours, which constantly play through it and express in finer matter human feelings, passions, emotions, and desires. All known shades, and many which are at present physically unknown to us, all of these exist upon each of the superphysical planes of nature, as they are called. at every ascending level, where the matter gets more and more tenuous, the colours become more delicate and more luminous, so that they might perhaps be described as higher octaves of colour. Let me go over these colours with you, giving the principal hues and shades in the aura of the emotional body of man, and then correlate them, saying what each colour refers to. Perhaps I might begin with an appearance which is not really a colour at all, and that is the colour black. Fortunately, it's rather rare in the aura of man. Black is the colour of hatred and malice, and very often it's in clouds in certain part of the aura, shot through with deep red flashes on this black background. And when you see that, you are watching black rage, a very terrible and dangerous condition. Then a scarlet cloud indicates irritability. And sometimes this shows itself as a large number of small red flecks on the outer edge of the aura of the person who's naturally rather irritable. And then when they become really cross and lose their temper, these red flecks blend together in a kind of scarlet cloud and disturb and upset the harmony of the whole aura, sometimes overshadowing and covering up the more beautiful and desirable colours. Brilliant scarlet, however, indicates noble indignation, and there's nothing to be said against that, even a great deal for it. Sometimes I wish that we human beings, and particularly the younger generation, would develop and use this quality of indignation, because there is so much in the world about which to be indignant, and from indignation often action can follow to put things right. There is, of course, a lurid and sanguinary red which can appear in the aura, and that indicates indulgence, sensual indulgence and sexuality. A dull, hard brown grey is the colour of selfishness and selfish, self-centred thinking and habits of mind. A dull, almost rust-red is the colour of avarice. And sometimes, if the person really is miserly, shall we say, really avaricious, this colour can be arranged in parallel bars across the astral body, illustrating the fact, by the by, that the miser is thus self-imprisoned by his own miserliness. Then a greenish brown lit up by deep red or scarlet flashes is the colour of jealousy. So you see there's an idea there of the green eye of jealousy being found to have some truth in fact, just as seeing red when you're very, very angry is not very far from the mark. The aura becomes suffused with the red of anger when we lose our tempers. And as I shall be saying a little later on, these undesirable as well as the desirable forces which we give vent to impinge upon other people and affect them adversely when they're destructive and favorably when they're constructive thoughts, feelings, and powers. Then there is a heavy leaden grey which you see about people sometimes, This is the color of depression. And like the brown, red of avarice, this gray color is often arranged in parallel lines, conveying the impression of a cage. The gray of depression is also very contagious. If you're in the presence of a very depressed person, if you're not careful, you find yourself getting very droopy on your own account. So it's necessary to be very positive and to fill yourself up with a sense of trust in life and joy of existence. And if you can, you can drive away those dull clouds of despair and depression from other people by strong, positive thinking. Theosophy tells us a great deal about that, particularly if you'll study its teachings about thought power, its control and culture. That, by the by, though I said it somewhat without thinking, thought power, its control and culture, that is the title of a wonderful book on the subject by Dr. Annie Besant. You can get it from our library or our bookstalls. A livid grey is the colour of fear, which can spread from one person to another to cause panic. Indeed, that is one of the ways in which panic arises. A few people become terribly afraid. They throw out from their auras this livid grey-looking force. It strikes the auras of other people, causes them to become frightened, and so it spreads like many other feelings, till you get a kind of panic spreading under the fairly well-known laws of mob psychology. A dull and heavy crimson in the aura signifies selfish love, interned upon itself and always wanting a reward. Possessive love, you know, which can be such a curse, giving misery instead of the happiness which true and unselfish love ought to bring. That kind of love, purely unselfish, loving for love's sake, that shows in the aura by the colour rose. And when it's exceptionally brilliant and tinged with lilac, it's the colour of spiritual love for all humanity. By the by, the thought occurs to me there that we also have the saying, don't we, that the people who are in love see each other through rose-coloured spectacles. There's a certain truth in it, for rose is the colour of true love. Orange, now, that carries a very different message about the character of the person who has it in the aura. For orange is the colour of pride, personal pride and self-satisfaction, and even of ambition for one's own sake, climbing, for example. All that shows as orange in the aura, and it's very often in and around the area occupied by the physical head. Yellow, which is in the same position, is the colour of intellectual activity. It varies from a deep and dull tint through brilliant gold to clear and luminous lemon or primrose yellow. Each of these different shades being indicative of a quality of the mind and the habitual intellectual life of the person. So that according to the use to which the intellect is put, so will the yellow be dull or brilliant. There is a dull yellow ochre which can be seen sometimes, and that's the colour of mental faculty applied to purely selfish purposes. A clear gamboge yellow is the colour of unselfish mental activity. Primrose yellow, as I've just been saying, is the colour of intellect devoted to spiritual ends only, to the gaining of understanding of the great principles of life and of other people, to the end of deeper wisdom and a more harmonious relationship with one's fellow men. Primrose yellow indicates that particular use of the human intellect. Gold is pure intellect applied to philosophy or mathematics, and often indicates also flashes of intuitive perception, spiritual intuitiveness, which often can reveal truths that are unattainable by the intellect alone. Suddenly we have a flash of realization, deep understanding of a person or a problem. Well, the color of that high intellectual activity and inspiration is often a pure and beautiful gold. Perhaps that's the origin of the nimbus or the halo. For highly developed people have a good deal of this beautiful golden colour in their aura, and it's in and around the head, as I was saying, yellow was just now. And I expect that people could see the high intellectual activity around advanced people, the saints and others, and so indicated it in art as a golden nimbus or halo. Green in general in the aura, if you see it, indicates an adaptable kind of a person on the whole. But a grey-green refers to the presence of deceit and cunning. Emerald green is the colour of versatility, ingenuity, and resourcefulness, particularly when unselfishly applied. This glows in the aura like a veritable emerald jewel shining in and around the head. A pale, luminous blue-green indicates deep sympathy and compassion, as also the power of perfect adaptability to any occasion, for example. A bright apple-green, which you see in the aura of people who are in splendid health, that's the colour of a strong vitality. Then there are the blues. I haven't touched on those, have I? There's a dark, clear blue, which is the colour of pure religious feeling. That is to say, worship, adoration, without any thought of return whatever. If, however, there is the idea of getting some benefit from God or whoever is being worshipped, or of making some kind of a bargain, as if one would say, I will do this in terms of religion, give money or burn candles or help somebody, if in return I may receive divine grace, blessing, and an improvement in my affairs. That kind of a religion, and I'm afraid there can be, can't there, a certain amount of the bargaining spirit in our petitions to the deity? Well, if there is, and you'll agree, won't you, that it should be avoided, it's not real religion and love of God at all, but if it's there, then it will show itself as a kind of blue tinged with grey, or even with brown, where fear or selfishness comes in and mars the beauty of the clear, dark blue of a true religious feeling. If a person rises on the wings of devotion into an experience of the of the veritable presence of God, then that shows itself as a light, pale, almost sky blue, and a luminous lilac blue, a sort of lovely lavender, which is usually accompanied by sparkling golden stars, right up above the top of the head. These colors indicate the higher spirituality and lofty spiritual aspirations. Joy shows itself in a general brightening and radiance of both the mental and the emotional bodies, and in a peculiar rippling over the surface of the aura of the truly happy person. Cheerfulness manifests as a modified bubbling form of this rippling effect. Surprise is shown in the aura by a sharp constriction of the mental body, usually communicated to both the physical and the emotional bodies. Now, reading the aura is not so easy as one might think. Human emotions, you know, are hardly ever unmixed, and it's unusual to see these colors as perfectly pure. More usually, they're mixtures. The purity of many colors can be dimmed by the hard brown gray of selfishness, or tinged with the deep orange of pride. When reading the full meaning of colors in the auras of people, several other points have also to be taken into consideration. There's the general brilliance of the emotional body, the comparative definiteness or indefiniteness of its outline, and the relative brightness of the different centers of force. Each of these refer to the degree of development, the evolutionary standing of the person, and to the way they are thinking and living their lives. And one has to remember these things when studying the aura. Of course, one would never dream of looking at a person's aura unless one were particularly asked, any more than one would ever read another person's letter or pry into their lives. So one would never, unless asked, and in order to help them by a deeper understanding, one would never look into the auras of another person uninvited. With regard to the positions of the various colors in the auras, the yellow of intellect, the rose of affection, and the blue of devotion are always found in the upper part of the emotional aura. The colors of selfishness, avarice, deceit, and hatred are in the lower part, whilst the mass of sensual feeling usually floats about between the two. Then there's another aspect of this subject which ought to be considered, and a very practical one, which is that there is a continual interaction between our superphysical and our physical bodies, and our health is definitely affected by the nature of our habitual thoughts and emotions. The habits, perhaps forced upon us by circumstances difficult to control, the habits of stress and tension and excessive desire, if habitual, can definitely set up tendencies to ill health and even disease, if you can believe it, in the physical body. A very great doctor has stated this fact in these words, and I'm quoting now just briefly from that wonderful book, Man the Unknown by Dr. Alexis Carrel. Here is what he says about this interaction of our states of mind and feeling and the conditions of our bodies. He says, envy, hate, fear, when these sentiments are habitual, are capable of starting organic changes and genuine diseases. Moral suffering profoundly disturbs health. Businessmen who do not know how to fight worry die young. Emotions determine the dilation or the contraction of the small arteries through the vasomotor nerves. They are therefore accompanied by changes in the circulation of the blood in tissues and organs. Pleasure causes the skin of the face to blush or flush. Anger and fear turn it white. The affective areas stimulate or stop these secretions or modify their chemical constitution. It has been proved that a moral shock may cause marked changes in the blood. Thought can generate organic lesions. The instability of modern life, the ceaseless agitation, and the lack of security create states of consciousness which bring about nervous and organic disorders of the stomach and of the intestines, defective nutrition, and the passage of intestinal microbes into the circulatory apparatus. Various infections of the kidney and bladder are the remote results of mental and moral unbalance. Such diseases are almost unknown in social groups where life is simpler and not so agitated, where anxiety is less constant. And then he closes this particular paragraph with these splendid words. Likewise, says Dr. Carrel, likewise, those who keep the peace of their inner self in the midst of tumult are immune from nervous and organic disorders. Man thinks, invents, loves and suffers, admires and prays with his brain and all his organs. Can we then control our thoughts and feelings and change the appearance of our auras, and so perhaps gain better health? Indeed we can, and Theosophy has a great deal of helpful guidance to offer. It says that the aura can be subjected to the control of the mind and the will. Theosophy teaches that we can change our nature and therefore our auras, just as we can change the expression of our faces, and that both the superphysical and the physical changes are produced by thought power and will power. Harmonious and outward-turned thoughts and feelings beautify and expand the aura, and the nature, of course, as well. Discordant and self-centered thoughts deform the aura and make it ugly. And now, following that thought, that theosophical teaching, let me, as I close, give you a kind of formula for health and happiness. 8 rules, if you like. Here they are. Don't continually look for trouble. Learn to like work, thus avoiding tension when work is disliked. Have a hobby which gets your mind off work tension, and during work, relax occasionally and briefly and think of the hobby. Learn to like people. Avoid grudges against anyone, for this is disastrous. We have to live with people, so let us learn to like them. be satisfied when the situation is such that you cannot readily and easily change it. If you cannot easily adjust the situation, adjust yourself to it. Learn to accept adversity. Don't let it defeat you. Don't brood on trouble, and above all, don't wallow in self-pity and remorse. Learn to say the cheerful, humorous thing. Never say the mean or cruel thing. Help others to feel better, and you'll feel better yourself, an old adage. Meet problems with decision. Decide what you're going to do, and then stop thinking about it. That's a kind of practical theosophy, and as such a way of thinking and living is followed, and as high ideals are put into practice, and one's life becomes more and more purified from selfishness, then the whole aura grows brighter, larger, more radiance. And we shed that radiance about us, you know, wherever we go. This evidence of progress in evolution would seem to be implied in that beautiful text, which says, it's from Proverbs, chapter 4, verse 18. You might like to look it up, and perhaps I might close with this beautiful text from Proverbs. The path of the just is as the shining light that shineth more and more unto the perfect day.